I'll tell you about that in a moment. Could we pause for prayer as we ask God's blessing upon our time together? Our Father, we pause in your presence this morning to invoke your blessing upon our gathering together this morning. We pray for our speaker, Dr. Reed, that you would endow him with your wisdom and guidance as he proclaims your word. Bless us in this hour and bless our time together, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. It's a distinct pleasure for me as chairman of the lecture committee to introduce our speaker this morning, Dr. Marty Reed, professor of Greek and New Testament here at Southeastern Baptist Seminary since 1989. Professor Reed earned his Bachelor of Arts degree at Lenoir Ryan College in 1978, and he went on to graduate studies at Southwestern Baptist Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas. There he received his MDiv in 1981, studied New Testament at Princeton Seminary and earned the THM degree there in 1982, and then returned to Southwestern where he completed his Doctor of Philosophy degree in 1986. He joined the faculty at Palm Beach Atlantic College in 1986 and continued to teach there until his coming to Southeastern in 1989. His wife, Dana, is with us this morning, and we're happy to have you here, Dana. And he has been the author of a number of articles and has a forthcoming book, Augustinian and Pauline Rhetoric in Romans 5, A Study of Early Christian Rhetoric. It's a distinct pleasure for me personally to be the one to introduce the speaker this morning, because he and his wife, when we moved here a little over a year ago, were the first to invite us into their home, and we really have appreciated that over this time that we've been here. And they're also, we rejoice with them as they look forward to the birth of their first child. It's a distinct pleasure then this morning to introduce to you Dr. Marty Reed, Professor of Greek and New Testament here at Southeastern.
Let me say as a prelude to this presentation that it actually represents a part of my forthcoming book, so some of the ideas and arguments I will not be able to develop completely, but you'll be able to get an idea of what I'm thinking about the book of Romans. One of the most recent and important developments within New Testament studies is the emergence of rhetorical criticism. In a groundbreaking article published in 1976, Wilhelm Wüllner set forth the proposal of interpreting the Pauline epistles as argumentative discourse. In this study, Wüllner attempted to demonstrate that the epistle of Romans resembles an argumentative speech whose construction was governed by rhetorical theory. In comparison to earlier studies which limited the study of rhetoric to the stylistic level, Wüllner offered a more holistic approach in his interpretation of Romans. Interpreting text as argumentative discourse subsequently became the distinguishing mark of the new rhetorical criticism. Shortly after Wüllner's study, Hans-Dieter Betz wrote the first full-length commentary which employed a rhetorical approach. Betz's commentary on Galatians was first published in the Hermeneia series in 1979 and later appeared in a German edition in 1988. Though not without its weaknesses, Betz's rhetorical analysis of Galatians represented a watershed in New Testament studies. As the subdiscipline broadened, the Pauline epistles became the primary testing field for the application of rhetorical criticism. Scholarly interest was stimulated further by George Kennedy's book, New Testament Interpretation Through Rhetorical Criticism, published in 1984. As a well-known classic scholar, Kennedy outlined a methodology of rhetorical criticism that bridged the gap between classical and biblical studies. Kennedy's methodology became very influential as a host of New Testament scholars began to publish numerous studies which embraced his approach. In 1992, Kennedy's contribution was recognized by a festschrift entitled Persuasive Artistry, Studies in New Testament Rhetoric in Honor of George Kennedy. The present state of affairs is illustrated by the 1994 monograph, Rhetorical Criticism of the Bible, a comprehensive bibliography with notes on history and method. The discussion indicates that the Pauline epistles have been successfully analyzed in various degrees according to rhetorical invention, arrangement, and style. Many critics follow the working assumption that Paul implemented rhetorical theory in the composition of his letters. Dwayne Watson, a leader in the field of New Testament rhetoric, summarizes the matter as follows. If Paul's epistles were to be read in churches, a logical assumption is that they were fashioned in a way closely akin to a speech. It is conceded that since the body of the ancient letter was dictated by the needs of the author, one cannot rule out the use of rhetorical theory here. Paul, needing to communicate over vast distances, has a rhetorical need to be persuasive and has used rhetorical theory in his letter body. Taking this premise as a point of departure, my purpose this morning is to propose a rhetorical reading of Romans. The presentation follows Kennedy's methodology for rhetorical criticism and proceeds in five major stages. First, identification of the rhetorical unit. Second, establishment of the rhetorical situation. Third, consideration of the unit's rhetorical species. Fourth, analysis of the unit's rhetorical composition. And fifth, a final reflection upon the manner in which the unit addressed the rhetorical situation. By employing Kennedy's procedure, the paper also offers an introduction to rhetorical criticism. In Kennedy's methodology, the first step in the analysis is the identification of the rhetorical unit. He explains that the unit must have a discernible beginning and ending connected by some major action or argument. To treat Romans as a self-contained unit or discourse requires no detailed explanation. Furthermore, even though some major textual problems exist, we can identify its beginning and ending to include 1 through 15, and 15 through 16:27. Formed critically, these texts represent the prescript and thanksgiving in the introduction of the letter and the epistolary postscript in the conclusion. The major argument which Paul attempts to advance is that a mutuality exists among himself and the audience in light of what God has accomplished through Jesus the Messiah. The subtext which governs Paul's rhetoric is his convictions concerning the covenant. His argument is rhetorical in the sense that he attempts to persuade the audience of his position so as to modify their situation. According to Aristotle, rhetoric encompasses an ability in each particular case to see the available means of persuasion. This means that a work of rhetoric is essentially pragmatic. As Lord Bitzer explains, it comes into existence for the sake of something beyond itself. It functions ultimately to produce action or change in the world. It performs some task. In short, rhetoric is a mode of altering reality, not by the direct application of energy to objects, but by the creation of discourse, which changes reality through the mediation of thought and action. The rhetor alters reality by bringing into existence a discourse of such character that an audience, in thought and action, is so engaged that it becomes mediator of change. In this sense, rhetoric is always persuasive. In identifying Romans as a rhetorical unit, the next task is to define its rhetorical situation. Lord Bitzer explains that a particular discourse comes into existence because of some specific condition or situation which invites utterance. He then defines rhetorical situation, quote, as a natural context of persons, events, objects, relations, and an exigency which strongly invites utterance. This invited utterance participates naturally in the situation, is in many instances necessary to the completion of situational activity, and by means of its participation with situation, obtains its meaning and its rhetorical character, end quote. Although the relationship between Paul and the Roman church is a debated issue, we should read Romans as a situational letter. This then implies that the epistle does not represent Paul's magnus opus of justification by faith, nor does it present his last will and testament as suggested by Gunther Bornkamm, nor does the letter simply intend to function as a preparatory interlude for Paul's relief trip to Jerusalem, as Jacob Yurvel espouses. Rather, Romans presents a situational argument addressed to the exigency of a particular audience. If this is the case, what then is its rhetorical situation? In the most recent discussion, scholars have emphasized that Romans 14:1 through 15:13 offers important clues for understanding the situation of the argument. In this section, Paul discusses problems which had arisen because of disputes concerning dietary regulations, persons judging one another, the practice of certain Jewish traditions, and relations between Jewish and Gentile Christians. Paul specifies two groups of people among the audience, the weak in faith, first mentioned in 14:1, and the strong referred to in 15:1. A common reading views the Paronesis of Romans as a reflection of Paul's experience at Corinth, which of course implies that the text has no real bearing on the immediate situation of the audience. However, an interpretation which has gained significant support suggests that the two groups that Paul mentions refer to Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians within the Roman congregation. Thus, Paul seeks to modify the exigency of conflict which had erupted because of their differences. Although time does not permit me to develop the second interpretation, the evidence within the letter, as well as the extra-biblical data, for example, offered by Tacitus, certainly support it. According to this reconstruction, Paul was addressing an internal problem. It was not a question of belief, but a problem of status, position, and definition. So Paul sought to modify the rhetorical exigence by establishing mutual relations among the audience. This aim not only holds true for the audience, but also for Paul. In other words, he also seeks to establish a mutual relationship between himself and the audience. In my estimation, this is why the notion of mutuality furnishes a suitable rubric for describing the rhetoric and argument of Romans. In my previous writings, I have developed this thesis in some detail. To summarize the rhetorical situation of Romans, the overriding problem was a problem of mutuality. Paul sought to modify this rhetorical exigence by eliminating the disaffection within the audience and by gaining their support for his own endeavors. With the rhetorical situation of Romans defined, we next consider its rhetorical species. Our discussion has indicated that the situation of the argument governs the nature of the rhetorical speech. The ancient handbooks classify the speech according to three basic genera or species, each related to a particular social context. First of all, the judicial speech aimed to accuse and defend. Judicial rhetoric concerned itself with events of the past and was mostly employed in a courtroom or legal setting. As the second classification, deliberative rhetoric offered advice and exhortation and attempted to persuade or dissuade certain actions. When we deliberate, we ponder or think about actions which are most advantageous for the future. In its social context, deliberative rhetoric was most appropriate in a council setting. And here in the paper, I give an extended discussion of how Gamaliel's speech in Acts 5:33-39 provides a good example of deliberative rhetoric. The third genus of rhetoric is epidiotic, with its two major traits being praise and blame. It was quite common in funeral orations and was sometimes described as ceremonial or demonstrative rhetoric. Epidiotic, in celebrating or condemning someone or something, does not seek an immediate action or judgment. It primarily attempts to increase or undermine assent to certain values. Kennedy suggests that epidiotic can be taken as a drip pen category, which implies that this kind of rhetoric could also be employed in other kinds of social settings. In actual practice, scholars have had difficulty in classifying the Pauline epistles according to the rhetorical genera. Consequently, this paper does not allow me to address this issue wholeheartedly, so I will simply make some observations about the rhetorical species of Romans. First of all, the majority of scholars argue that Romans is epidiotic or demonstrative rhetoric. For example, Robert Jewett suggests that Romans represents an ambassadorial letter written by Paul as a representative of the gospel. Paul's employment of epidiotic may be due to the fact that he had never actually visited the church at Rome. Thus, ceremonial or demonstrative rhetoric seemed the most appropriate for the rhetorical situation. While this explanation may plausibly explain the rhetorical species of Romans in a general fashion, scholars have failed to articulate a comprehensive and convincing argument for the position. For example, Kennedy begins his discussion by simply stating that Romans is more epideictic in intent. His major argument stems from his interpretation of Romans 12:1 through 15:13. In Kennedy's estimation, the exhortations focus upon attitude and belief rather than action. As he explains, these pastoral headings do not, as elsewhere, convert the letter into deliberative rhetoric. While I am inclined to agree with Kennedy's interpretation, a more comprehensive analysis is needed before we can come to any definite conclusions. The remaining task is to analyze each section of Romans to see if, in fact, the entire argument is epideictic. To my knowledge, this has not yet been attempted. To conclude this part of the discussion, I offer an assessment of this stage of Kennedy's methodology. First, the way in which we go about determining rhetorical species of any New Testament text or document must be clarified and delineated in a more systematic way. Second, we must give more attention to comparing Paul's letters with other rhetorical speeches, as represented by Cicero and Demosthenes. Thirdly, our methodology must take into account the fact that Paul's letters are much longer than the conventional ancient epistle. This holds especially true for Romans. Given the complexity of his arguments, it may be that one single letter includes more than one rhetorical species, and a number of scholars have come to this conclusion. Finally, we must be cautious about the way we apply the ancient handbooks in this kind of analysis. Their principles are, for the most part, heuristic, leaving a good deal of flexibility in their actual use and application. And of course, the ultimate question that we must ask is whether the identification of rhetorical gonara contribute to our understanding of the Pauline letter. I think that it can, but there's a lot of more work that we need to do on this point. The next part of the paper considers the rhetorical composition of Romans. This section of the paper focuses upon determining how the various sections function together to present the argument and how the argument addresses the rhetorical situation. As we have already stated, the structure of Paul's letter resembles a speech framed by its epistolary prescript and postscript. In Romans, the prescript begins by establishing Paul's credibility as a representative of the gospel, verse 1. He then introduces his gospel in summary form in verses 2 through 6. Since ethos was one of the essential modes of persuasion, the speaker had to first establish his character. This was accomplished in the argument's introduction. Above all, the speaker's character should be established by the thought and content of the speech. This was especially important for Paul, since he was not personally known by the audience. Hence, he had to establish a rhetorical bridge between himself and his hearers. He accomplishes this by underscoring what they already had in common. Of particular importance is the covenantal notion of kletos, called, a term which Paul employs three times in verses 1 through 7. Not only does he present himself as a called apostle, verse 1, but he also describes his audience as called by Jesus Christ, verse 6, and called to be saints, verse 7. This use of kletos represents the rhetorical technique of conduplicatio, the repetition of a word in succeeding clauses to provide amplification. In a rather subtle way, then, Paul conveys the idea that a mutual relationship already existed between himself and the audience, not because of their human relationship, but because of their identity with Jesus the Messiah. Consequently, the Christological focus of the argument becomes very apparent in verses 2 through 6, and I should also mention the fourfold repetition of the Christological title in verses 1, 4, 6, and 7. There is also another possible reference to Christ in the noun form of pistis in verse 5. The expression for obedience of faith could refer to Christian obedience prompted by Christ's faithfulness. In my estimation, when Paul employs the noun form of pistis in Romans, he oftentimes uses the term Christologically. His reference to obedience in verse 5 indicates that the rhetorical situation encompassed questions about the ethical and social dimensions of the gospel. In short, the rhetorical problem involved matters related to covenant identity and covenant maintenance rather than individual faith. Since the prescript only frames the speech, the actual introduction to the argument commences in verse 8. The rhetorical handbooks agree that the exordium's purpose is to make the audience receptive or teachable, well-disposed, and attentive. In its entirety, the exordium, the introduction, includes Romans 1, 8 through 15. Paul begins by offering praise of the audience in verse 8. An extended prayer then follows in which he speaks of his desire to visit the audience in verses 9 through 11. According to Cicero, prayer furnished a means for the speaker to gain the goodwill of the audience. The introduction also introduces the basic purpose of the argument. In 1, 11 through 12, Paul introduces his intent to offer mutual encouragement, which in turn would lead to the audience's reciprocation. While this subtle introduction to Romans remains very vexing for many interpreters, the technique of insinuatio, the subtle approach, plausibly explains Paul's rhetoric. Often when the speaker faced a difficult situation, it was more appropriate to introduce the argument indirectly. We can understand Paul's reticence for directness, since he was unknown by the church at Rome. Consequently, his attempt to move the audience to a specific judgment only appears in the conclusion of the argument in 15:14 through 33. Rhetorical theory thus explains this seeming irreconcilability in Romans. Quintilian, for example, advises that certain aspects of the argument are more appropriately treated in the conclusion rather than the introduction. Paul seems to be following this technique in Romans. Basically speaking, Romans 15 through 33 as the conclusion to the speech reinforces Paul's purpose to establish mutuality. A more detailed analysis reveals that this concluding section reinforces 1, 8 through 15. Paul begins with a summation of the occasion of the argument in 15, 14 through 16, which recapitulates Romans 1, 11 through 12. In verse 15, he describes the letter as a reminder. By alluding to the problem of boasting in verse 17, Paul makes a final appeal to those who would oppose his position. Paul then turns to clarify the situation in 15, 22 through 29, explaining the nature of his visit. This section amplifies the occasion of the letter, clarifies the manner in which Paul expects the audience to participate within the argument, and closes with a final appeal for their prayerful intercession. As the ancient handbooks explain, the function of the speech's conclusion was to summarize the argument, to arouse the audience's emotions, and thereby to make a final appeal for them to adopt the speaker's position. We next move to consider how the argument unfolds in Romans 1:16 through 15:13. When proceeding from the introduction to the rest of the argument, the handbooks advise that the speaker make smooth transitions. While commentators have always recognized the thematic significance of Romans 1:16 through 17, its contextual function remains an interpretive crux. Here, Paul employs the rhetorical technique of transition, described by Quintilian as either transitus or transgressio. Its function is to signal the sequence to the various parts of the speech and to announce the major topics of the narration which follow. Introduced by the explanatory four in verse 16a, Paul constructs a syllogistic argument to establish the legitimacy of his position and to strengthen his weakest premise that his gospel was universal and therefore appropriate to modify the situation of the audience. As a hinge in the argument, verses 16 through 17 give theological credence to Paul's rhetoric and also introduce the proposition of the argument later developed in 3:21 through 31. The opening statement in verse 16a, "I am not ashamed of the gospel," sustains Paul's position within the situation. Here Paul draws from the Septuagintal form of some Old Testament psalms and prophetic texts which allude to God's faithfulness. A similar expression appears in Romans 9:33, where Paul employs Isaiah 10:11 Christologically. "The one who believes in him will not be put to shame." It is important to note that similar texts furnish the semantic feel for Paul's righteousness language. Consequently, Verse 16a does not simply signify his unashamed assent to the gospel, Cranfield, nor does it only represent his personal confession, Caseman. In its context, the declaration as an echo of Old Testament covenantal texts is a declaration of God's faithfulness. Though rhetorically subtle, Paul thus predicates the legitimacy of his position on the premise that God can be trusted. He develops this argument in the complete syllogism of verses 16b through 17 with two supporting arguments, both introduced by 4 in 16b and 17a. Though we do not have time to do a complete exegesis, I will address some of the text's central elements. First, we should notice that Paul begins by describing the gospel theocentrically as the event which unleashes God's power to bring about salvation. As Caseman correctly emphasizes, the gospel represents God's dynamic activity. So we should be very careful in thinking of Paul's understanding of the gospel in only individualistic terms. As a Christian Jew, Paul retains his understanding of Jewish creational monotheism, a major pillar in Jewish theology. However, Paul's rereading of the covenant story comes into play in 16b, when he states that the salvation provided through the gospel is for everyone who has faith. Therefore, covenant membership is no longer determined by ethnicity nor geographical location. It is determined by one's identity with Jesus as the Messiah. Especially important is Paul's use of the inclusive pronoun pos, all, in verse 16, which reinforces his rhetoric of mutuality. Thus, salvific faith represents one's identity with Jesus. Given the rhetorical situation, Paul seeks to clarify that this relationship to Jesus not only defines the covenant community, but it also determines one's position and status, as Paul makes clear, both for the Jew and the Greek. Paul further elaborates his definition of the gospel in 1:17. He explains that, quote, the righteousness of God is being revealed in the gospel. Although the traditional Lutheran reading interprets the phrase, the righteousness of God, to refer to God's imputed righteousness to the individual, known as the forensic or judicial view, it is more accurate to take the expression in its Hebraic sense to denote God's covenantal faithfulness. This exegesis ties in much better with Paul's previous argument that the gospel represents God's power. The expression in verse 17, from faith unto faith, has generated a great deal of discussion. While commentators such as Zeisler take the two references to faith to be practically synonymous, I would suggest that Paul's repetition of faith, pistis, in verse 17, resembles the rhetorical technique of antistasis, the repetition of a word in a different or contrary sense. This interpretation is syntactically supported since the references to faith are introduced by two different prepositions, the first eich, out of, and the second eis, into. The two references also occur in various cases, the genitive case and also the accusative case. The semantic structure of the expression therefore suggests that Paul gives a bipolar reference to faith in verse 17. The major statement in verse 17a states that God's covenantal faithfulness is being revealed in the gospel. As an adverbial construction, from faith to faith signifies the means and purpose of the revelation. By this, the means by which God's faithfulness is demonstrated is through the faithfulness of Christ. Here I would suggest Paul in turn employs the term pistis, faith, in a similar fashion that we find in Romans 3:3, where he uses the term pistis to refer to the faithfulness of God. In verse 17, then, the second phrase explains that the purpose of the revelation is to bring about or elicit the response of individual faith. The final portion of the syllogism then appears in verse 17b. The citation from Habakkuk 2:4 provides an external authority for the argument, a form of argumentation quite common in rhetorical theory. With its Christological orientation, Paul employs Habakkuk 2:4 as a messianic text. And of course, this is much different than the traditional reading, but we can translate it this way. The one who is righteous by Christ's faithfulness shall find life. Theologically, Paul stresses that God's covenant with his people is based upon Christ's faithfulness demonstrated on the cross. As Paul explains, we then enter into the covenant relationship by identifying with Jesus as the Messiah. The response of individual faith, which Paul explains in verse 16b, conversely represents the subjective dimension of the salvation experience. In its entirety, Romans 1, 16 through 17 furnishes a transitional hinge for Paul's argument and also provides a theological basis for his rhetoric of mutuality. In argumentation, Aristotle stresses that the two essential elements of the oration included a statement and proof of the argument. In its most basic form, Paul states his case in 1:18 through 3:20 and then proves his argument in 3:21 through 11:36. As the exhortation to the speech, Romans 12:1 through 15:13 explains how Paul expects the audience to participate in the argument. In some cases, dependent upon the nature of the speech, a narration of the facts of the case was included. Within Paul's argument, the narration, or the Latin term narratio, encompasses 1:18 through 3:20. As Quintilian suggests, sometimes it is necessary to divide the narration into subdivisions. Paul arranges his narration into three major sections. First, 1:18 through 32. Second, 2:1 through 3:8, and then third, 3:9 through 20. Each of these units have their own propositions developed with three major topics. And here you should refer especially to 1:18, 2:2, and 3:9. Paul seeks to establish his premise that God's judgment is universal and impartial. Within the rhetorical situation, he addresses the problem of disfaction and boasting, which evidently erupted on both sides of the issue. The Gentiles boasted since they had been grafted into the covenant, and the Jews boasted because they were the chosen people. Paul's purpose was to equalize both parties, the Gentiles in 1:18 through 32 and the Jews in 2:1 through 3:8. 3:9 through 20 then brings Paul's arguments to its summation, signaled by the rhetorical question in 3:9a. And here I quote, "What then is the case? Are we Jews any better off? Certainly not, for we have already advanced the argument that all people, both Jews and Greeks, are under the power of sin." Thus, Paul's rhetoric of mutuality becomes a two-sided coin. Neither is there any difference between those who reside within the community, nor is there any difference between those outside of the covenant community. 3:19 through 20 provides the final conclusion to the narration. Verse 19 recapitulates the major proposition within each subsection of the narration. 1, God's wrath is being revealed against all forms of ungodliness and against those who attempt to suppress his truth. 1:18. 2, God's judgment is according to the truth. 2:2. And 3, God's judgment is universal, 2:1 through 3:8. And finally, sin reigns universally, 3:9 through 20. In addition, verse 20 provides a transition in the argument by presenting the antithesis to the proposition, which Paul develops in 3:21 through 31. Following the narration, it was sometimes necessary to include a section which presented a systematic treatment of the essential matters under discussion. Known as the proposition, or the Latin term propositio or partitio, its purpose was to isolate the points susceptible to ambiguity. A particular form of the proposition developed the points of agreement and disagreement with the opponents. The proposition of Romans includes 3:21 through 31. Verses 21 through 26 develop a Christological argument whose major purpose is to explain how God fulfilled his covenantal promises through Christ's faithfulness. Notice especially verse 21. "But now, apart from the law, God's covenantal faithfulness has been manifested, although borne witness by the law and the prophets, namely God's covenantal faithfulness through the faith of Jesus Christ for all who believe. 3:27 through 31 then addresses points of disagreement with Paul's opponents. And here I'm primarily referring to the Jewish sympathizers who would have been present within the congregation. A central issue within the rhetorical situation concerned the function of the law and the maintenance of the covenant. We see this matter first appear in 2:17 through 3:8, where Paul basically argues that the Jews failed to live up to their privileges. Then more explicitly, in the conclusion of the narration, verse 20 concludes that law observance is not necessary for maintaining the new covenant. 3:21 through 26 thus presents a Jewish theology of the cross, whereby Christ's act provides the ultimate atonement of sin. Within the rhetorical situation, the first section of the proposition, as I mentioned, represents points of disagreement. In verses 27 through 31 of chapters 3, Paul presents the points of disagreement, which center upon the function of the law. Introduced by a rhetorical question, verse 27a resumes the theme of boasting. Quote, "What then becomes of our boasting?" The question clarifies that the major issue was not acceptance of Jesus as Messiah, but the matter of covenant status and obligation. 3:27 concludes that boasting becomes illegitimate for both the Jew and the Gentile in light of Christ's provision of the cross. The rationale for the argument appears in verse 28. Paul thus offers his judgment upon the rhetorical situation. 3:29 then introduces a second point of disagreement, which addresses the distinction between Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians. Paul develops his argument from the premise of Jewish creational monotheism. A rhetorical question introduces the argument in verse 29a. Quote, "Is God the God of the Jews only? Is he not also the God of the Gentiles?" "Yes, of course," end quote. The argument thus establishes the mutuality of God, recapitulating 3:22. The rationale then follows in verse 30 in the form of a conditional sentence. The protasis in verse 38 states the premise from the previous argument in verse 30, since God is one. The protasis then follows in verse 30b. "Then he will justify the circumcised on the basis of Christ's faithfulness, and the uncircumcised by Christ's faithfulness." 3:31 then draws the final denial of the charge that Paul's gospel nullifies the Jewish Torah. Rather than abolishing the Torah, Paul argues, this faith or principle in fact establishes it. The Christological interpretation of faith in verse 30 is strengthened on two accounts. One, by the plausibility of a Christological interpretation of 3:21 through 26, and second, by Paul's premise in Romans 10:4 that the Messiah represents the goal or end of the law for all who believe. And here I think it's interesting that in Romans 10:4, Paul employs the verbal form pistuo rather than the noun form to refer to individual faith. In the proposition of 3:21 through 31, Paul thus reinforces the belief that Christ's faithfulness provides the necessary and ultimate provision that makes the new covenant possible, and also that God makes no distinction within the covenant, and finally, that Jewish regulations were not necessary for covenant maintenance. In its entirety, the argument reinforces Paul's rhetoric of mutuality with its intent to modify the rhetorical situation. As we stated earlier, Aristotle explained that the two essential elements of the speech included the statement of the case and its proof. As the fourth section to the speech, the proof, the probatio, intended to substantiate the major proposition of the argument. The ancient rhetors considered the proof the most important part since it provided the climax to the speech. The proof of Romans includes two major sections, 4:1 through 8:32 and 9:1 through 11:36. The section includes a series of Christological arguments, each developed by its own proposition. Throughout the history of interpretation, scholars have experienced great difficulty in tracing the flow of the argument in Romans 4 through 11 for a number of reasons. For one, why does Paul refer to Jewish concerns in chapter 4 and then seemingly turn in a different direction in chapter 5? Furthermore, how do chapters 9 through 11 function? This last issue becomes especially acute since some commentators have concluded that Romans 9 through 11 offers nothing more than a digression or even an appendage to the main argument. To begin with, chapters 4 through 11 present a series of Christological arguments which Paul links together by the motif or topos of the law. And we don't have time to go into this in great detail at this moment, but you can compare 4:13 through 25, 5:12 through 21, 6:1 through 14, and 7:1 through 25, and 8:1 through 25. Chapter 4 begins this section by employing the Jewish tradition concerning the faithfulness of Abraham. Since Abraham was the father of the Jewish people, the proof section begins by retelling the story of the Abrahamic covenant. Commencing the proof in this way allows the proof section to unfold as a continuous narrative, which depicts the fulfillment of God's covenant with his people. While Romans 4 is most often taken to present Abraham as the model of Christian faith, another possibility is that Paul employs the Abrahamic tradition typologically to signify the faith of Christ. In other words, as a Christological argument, Abraham's faith exemplifies Christ's faith rather than individual faith, an interpretation which especially works well in light of Romans 4:16. As an example of Paul's Jewish rhetoric, a striking coherency thus becomes apparent in the Christological proof of Romans 4. In its immediate context, the proof strengthens the Christological argument of 3:21 through 26 and 3:27 through 31. Coming off the heels of the proposition, the rhetorical question in 4:1a provides the necessary linkage. Quote, "What then shall we say about Abraham, our father, according to the flesh?" To summarize the argument, Abraham entered into his covenant relationship by his response of faith, which actually preceded the giving of the Jewish Torah. In the same manner, the new covenant becomes established by Christ's faithfulness, thus making covenant membership possible for all who believe. Later on in chapter 8, Paul explains then that the function of the law has been replaced by the Holy Spirit. This means that the covenant relationship is no longer maintained by observing the Torah, the position of Jewish covenantal nomism, but by what Paul describes as walking or living according to the Spirit. Time does not permit us to examine Romans 5 and the following chapters in great detail. If you're interested, you can purchase my book. Let me simply mention that each chapter includes additional proofs which bolster the proposition in 3:21 through 31. The section climaxes with chapters 9 through 11, which addresses the final implication of Paul's argument. As I mentioned, one of the central questions in the interpretation of Romans concerns the function of Romans 9 through 11. Paul's explanation.